with asthma as a child and had always loved it when his mother played the doctor. Eddie was a good student and enjoyed life. He had a Christian girlfriend, and at night he performed regularly with the Rhythm Rascals, a jazz band in which he played the clarinet. He liked to spend any free days sailing his dinghy. Both of Eddie's parents came from large Jewish families. Some of his relatives worked in the diamond industry, but most were hard-working people running small businesses. Attending university was still unusual in families such as Eddie's, and they were proud of his achievements. Although the increasing threat of Nazism had been hanging over the Netherlands from the early 30s, life was looking rosy for Eddie. The German invasion of May 1940 and the occupation of the Netherlands would have come as a terrible shock. The war. In early 1941, the German occupiers forced the Dutch universities to exclude all Jewish staff and students. With the help of his lecturers at Leiden, Eddie was able to accelerate his studies, and he was the last Jewish student to receive a degree. He relocated to Amsterdam to be trained as a psychoanalyst, something that had to be done in secret in his teachers' homes. He moved into an apartment on the Nieuwe Herengracht, a beautiful, quiet canal near the Jewish quarter, which was home to most of the city's then 80,000 Jews. The occupiers were tightening the noose around the Jewish community, and Eddie became deeply worried. He was convinced that the Germans would put into practice the theories that Hitler had expressed much earlier in Mein Kampf. Nonetheless, he was surprised when he was arrested. On February 22nd and 23rd, 1941, the Germans rounded up 427 young Jewish men in Amsterdam, Eddie amongst them. This roundup, the first in the Netherlands, was in retaliation for the death of the Dutch Nazi and paramilitary Hendrik Kot, who was killed in a street battle with Jewish and non-Jewish resistance fighters. Eddie related the events in a 1981 newspaper article in the NRC Handelsblatt. "I had gone into town to pick up my bike. Somewhere in the Jewish quarter, I was stopped by a German soldier. 'Bist du Jude?' Why did I answer, 'Ja?' If I'd replied, 'Man, are you crazy? Me, a Jew?' I would have saved my life in that moment. Now, I had almost certainly thrown it away." Together with the other men, he was taken to a square between two synagogues, now called the Jonas Daniel Meyerplein, where they had to squat for hours while being beaten by German soldiers. Finally, they were carted off in trucks to a prison camp in the small town of Schorl. After their arrival, they were beaten again, harder this time, forced to run the gauntlet while the soldiers hit them with their rifle butts. For Eddie, the uncertainty and fear were worse than the blows. At that point, he and the other men had no idea what was going to happen to them. The 427 men were given an examination, and those who were too ill were exempted from deportation. Eddie saw an opportunity. Just as he would later in Auschwitz, he now benefited from being a doctor. He knew the symptoms of tuberculosis, and, helped partly by his asthma, was able to simulate this contagious disease. Together with 11 others who were also considered too ill for the transport, he was released. Running fast and zigzagging through fear of being shot while trying to escape, he reclaimed his freedom. The other 415 men were sent to Mauthausen, a hard labor quarry in Austria. Only two survived the war. Those who were released didn't fare well either. Of the 12 who were declared unfit for transport, Eddie was the only known survivor. This first roundup led to what was later called the February Strike. Tens of thousands of the people of Amsterdam refused to accept what was happening to their Jews and, under the leadership of the Communist Party, downed tools. Tram drivers and conductors stopped work. Dock and shipyard workers followed. Factories closed. Shops and offices emptied. It was an act of unprecedented courage. Unfortunately, but inevitably, the strike was violently suppressed. At the annual commemoration of the February strike, it is always said that only two men survived that first roundup, Max Nebig and Gerrit Blom. Eddie is never mentioned. This is probably because he wasn't one of the 415 who were carted off to Mauthausen, but one of the 12 who were exempted. After his release from Schor, Eddie did his best to resume his life. In 1942, things got too hot for him in Amsterdam, and he went into hiding with friends of his mother's in The Hague. As he found being cooped up in the house all day very difficult, his host proposed a solution. Eddie should flee to Switzerland. He set out, together with his then fiancée, but at the very first stop in Antwerp, things went wrong. They couldn't find the house where he was supposed to report, presumably because of an error in the handwritten address. After a few days of searching, the couple were forced to abandon their mission and return to the Netherlands. This is the story that Eddie would later tell. It is also possible that he sabotaged his flight himself. He had such a strong, deep bond with his mother that in the end he might not have been willing to abandon her. Shortly after his return to the Netherlands, an event took place that supports this possibility. Eddie's mother was picked up and taken to Westerbork transit camp. At the same time, the Jewish Council, the body that mediated between the occupiers and the Dutch Jews, was looking for Jewish doctors who were willing to work in Westerbork as volunteers. In return for their services, the doctors were given an assurance that they would be allowed to stay there and would not be deported out of the country. They were even allowed to have every second weekend off to visit home as a free man. Eddie volunteered for duty on the condition that his mother would be allowed to remain in Westerbork and would not be put on a transport farther east. The promise proved worthless. When Eddie arrived in Westerbork a few days later, his mother had already been deported to Auschwitz. Westerbork was a neatly maintained settlement with a well-functioning administration made up primarily of Jews. There was enough to eat, and there were facilities of all kinds, such as a hospital and a theater. But ultimately, of course, the Nazis were in charge, and every week there was a transport with 1,000 Jews being shipped off to the east on a freight train, almost all of them going to the place that was shrouded in rumor and uncertainty, yet feared by almost everyone as possibly their final destination, a place in Poland whose name they only heard on the freight train, Auschwitz. Eddie was one of the head doctors in Westerbork's small hospital and worked hard. He found one of his tasks unimaginably difficult. He had to examine prisoners who had been named for deportation. Those who were too ill received an exemption. Prisoners were constantly begging him to list friends or relatives as too ill for the transport, but the doctors had to be very cautious, as their work was regularly checked by the Germans. It was an impossible task that continued to torment Eddie long after the war, not least because, even then, some people were still angry with him for not listing a family member as unable to travel. In the hospital, Eddie worked with an 18-year-old nurse called Friedel, Frieda Komornik. Originally from Germany, she had ended up in the camp after an arduous flight. Eddie and Friedel fell in love, and he broke off his engagement with his fiancée. To be together, they had to marry. That, too, was possible in Westerbork. For months afterward, Eddie and Frieda lived in a room that was separated from the hospital ward by a flimsy cardboard partition. It was far from an ideal situation for a newly married couple, but they had each other and were happy enough, given the circumstances, until fate struck again. Despite the agreements Eddie had made with the Jewish Council, on September 14, 1943, he and Friedel were put on a transport to Auschwitz. Auschwitz. Immediately after the Germans left Auschwitz, Eddie described his experiences there in the notebook from which this book is reproduced. Sometimes he told his wife and children more about what had happened. He certainly suffered from the feelings of guilt that afflict every survivor. Why did I survive when all those others didn't? Besides unimaginable luck, it seems that it was also his love and longing for Friedel that kept him going. A particular strength of Last Stop Auschwitz is that it was written during the war and in the camp itself. The text has not been adapted or influenced by changing memories or knowledge that was only gained later after liberation. This makes the story very honest and gives it great historical value. It is often extremely confronting. A striking example is the story that Eddie tells about the period when things were going very badly for Friedel. He took it upon himself to speak to the Lagerarzt and asked him to save her life. That seems a ridiculous request in a place where extermination was in large part the reason for its existence and was the fate of so many of its prisoners, but astonishingly, the Lagerarzt agreed to his request. The story is even more astonishing when you realize the identity of that Lagerarzt, Josef Mengele. It was a name that meant so little to the prisoners at the time that Eddie didn't find it necessary to mention it in his notebook. But it is the name of a man who is now seen as one of the greatest war criminals in history. It is a disturbing thought, specifically because it makes us realize that the executioners of Auschwitz were not simply beasts or creatures from another planet, but ordinary people who were capable of making humane decisions. Does this event make Mengele less evil? Eddie answers this question himself in a conversation he has with Friedel about the inconsistent, seemingly inexplicable way the older members of the SS sometimes made kind decisions. He writes, "I don't think that's a point in their favor. On the contrary, the youngsters have been raised in the spirit of blood and soil. They don't know any better. But those older ones, like the Lagerarzt, show through those minor acts that they still harbor a remnant of their upbringing. They didn't learn this inhumanity from an early age and had no need to embrace it. That's why they're guiltier than the young Nazi sheep who have never known better." In other words, the fact that Mengele saved Friedel's life, and in doing so showed that he knew what humanity was, makes his behavior in Auschwitz even more reprehensible. The book ends with the liberation of Auschwitz in January 1945, but it took several months for the war to be over in the Netherlands, too. In that period, Eddie joined the Red Army, who arrived in the camp, and stayed there for a number of months to treat the sick. He then traveled to the rear to help treat the wounded soldiers. In an afterword Eddie wrote for the 1980 republication of the Dutch original of his book, he described what happened. After the SS had taken the great majority of the prisoners away on death marches to camps deep in Germany, a few thousand people were left behind in the Auschwitz hospital. Within several days of the first Russian troops entering the camp, a female medical officer arrived, a major. "I was asked to stay in the camp until the last Dutch patients, who managed to stay alive, had been transferred to Russia, and later to Holland. For 3 months, I did all kinds of difficult medical things, carrying out amputations and minor operations that were actually far beyond my capabilities. I had a busy life, and ate copious amounts of American canned chicken and beans. What's more, I had found a fur coat in Canada, the storehouse for all Jewish possessions, which I sold at a market. During the remaining 5 months in Auschwitz and in Russia, I used the money to buy a lot of eggs and cream, so that by the time I returned to Holland in July, I had quite a good nutritional status. I don't remember how I was psychologically. The reconstruction of events from so long ago is a precarious business. I remember very clearly that shortly after the entry of the Russians, we were taking turns near the gate to dance on a large portrait of Hitler we had found in one of the administrative buildings. I don't recall what I felt while doing so. I suspect that rather than a fine way of venting my hatred, I found it ridiculous. There was one feeling I definitely had. I have to let everyone know what happened here. If I record it now and everyone finds out about it, it will never happen again. At the same time, I wanted to leave it all behind me, as if I could liberate myself from all that was haunting me by getting it out and down on the page. An illusion. I got my hands on a very thick notebook, and have it still, in which I wrote an endless account in very small letters every day, sitting on the side of my bed in the former Polenstube. No one can doubt the facts and situations described. This is in contrast to today's books and TV scripts, which critics, because of unwillingness or otherwise, can suggest are influenced by the falsification of memories. During those post-liberation months, Eddie had no idea if Friedel was still alive. At first he was convinced that she was dead, that she must have died on the death march. As the stories of the death marches trickled through to Eastern Europe, he heard that there were survivors and regained hope. On May 23, 1945, soon after the liberation of the Netherlands, he sent a letter from Chernivtsi in Ukraine, then part of the Soviet Union, to the Red Cross in the Netherlands. He enclosed a letter to Friedel, in the hope that she might still be alive and that the Red Cross might be able to locate her. It was a letter full of longing and uncertainty. Now that the Netherlands had finally been liberated, he wanted to get there as soon as possible. A long journey through Eastern Europe and over the Mediterranean ensued. Eddie had left the Netherlands in a goods wagon. He returned in a passenger train. From Marseille, he traveled through Germany and crossed the Dutch border near the city of Enschede on July 24, 1945. As he didn't have any papers, he was taken to a reception center to be interviewed by a Red Cross worker. He began by giving his personal details, his name, and where he has been. And then the miracle happened. The Red Cross worker interrupted him to say that a Mrs. De Vint from Auschwitz had returned shortly before him. She was in a nearby hospital. On the day of his return to the Netherlands, Eddie was reunited with Friedel. After Auschwitz, Friedel and Eddie returned from the war intensely damaged. Eddie's problems were, above all, psychological. Friedel was also very traumatized, but her wounds were physical, too. She was infertile and suffered from ill health for many years. Almost all of their family and friends had been murdered, and they had no home to return to. It was some time before Eddie and Friedel were able to live together. Initially, she was hospitalized, and Eddie lived at the home of his psychiatrist. The Netherlands was so preoccupied with the reconstruction of its infrastructure and society that there was little time for their personal story. Bravely, Eddie and Friedel picked up their life together. Eddie sold the few family possessions that were left after the war, and they used the money to build a house on the outskirts of Amsterdam. Eddie continued his training as a psychoanalyst and began his own practice. But Auschwitz affected everything he did. As a psychoanalyst, he specialized in the treatment of people with serious war trauma. As early as 1949, he published his seminal essay, Confrontation with Death, in which the concentration camp syndrome was described for the first time. Ultimately, Eddie and Friedel's shared suffering and the pain from their trauma proved too great for their relationship. In 1957, 12 years after Auschwitz, they separated. At drawing lessons, Eddie met his second wife, a woman with a very different background. She was from Amsterdam, a good bit younger, and not Jewish. They went on to have three children together. Although energetic and a hard worker, Eddie was regularly overcome by the traumas he carried with him. He was treated at various times, including in the clinic of Jan Bastians, the professor of psychiatry who specialized in the treatment of war traumas, where he also underwent experimental treatment with psychedelic drugs to help him process his traumatic past. The pain and sorrow sometimes came from unexpected directions. Divorcing the wife with whom he had been through so much led some people to think poorly of him. And a section of the Jewish community saw his marriage to a non-Jewish woman as a betrayal. Every year, Eddie went to the memorial service of the Dutch Auschwitz Committee. Although many of those present saw him as a hero for dedicating his working life to helping the victims of war, there were some who turned their backs on him because of this betrayal. As a psychiatrist, Eddie published regularly and was in demand as a speaker at international conferences, specifically concerning the later consequences of war trauma. He was also successful in his second specialty, sexology, helping to found the first Dutch abortion clinic and publishing a survey of sexual preferences entitled Variation or Perversion. Later in his life, Eddie understood increasingly that traumas do not cease to exist with those directly involved, but that survivors pass them on to their children. He set up a foundation to gather research into and knowledge of this subject, the Stichting Ondersorg Psychische Orlogsgefolgen, or SOPO, the Foundation for the Investigation of the Psychological Consequences of War. It was an ambitious project, in which he was able to engage many international specialists. In 1984, 3 years before his death, he was given a royal honor by being made an officer in the Order of Oranje-Nassau, something he saw as more than just recognition of the good work he had done. For him, the honor was an acknowledgement of his survival having had a purpose. While working on SOPO, Eddie suffered a severe heart attack. A difficult period followed in which he grew weaker and weaker. His confrontation with his approaching death took him back to Auschwitz, and he fell victim to terrible fears and nightmares. After more than a month of illness, his damaged heart failed completely. Eddie died on September 27, 1987, at the age of 71. A note on this publication. After his return to the Netherlands, Eddie realized that most people were so happy that the war was over that, after an initial flurry, there was little interest in his stories about the death camps. Reconstruction was the priority. Nonetheless, he decided to persevere with his resolution to let people know what had happened so that it could never happen again, and it wasn't long before his story was published. The text about his experiences in Auschwitz, which he had written in the space of a few weeks sitting on the side of his wooden bed in the camp, was adopted virtually word for word, and at the start of 1946, Last Stop Auschwitz was published by the communist publisher Der Republik der Lettern with the title Einstation Auschwitz. Unfortunately, the publisher went bankrupt shortly after the book came out, and it was only available to the general public for a short period and soon forgotten. Amongst Dutch survivors, however, the book has long been treasured as one of the most important on Auschwitz. Consumed by the reconstruction of his own life, Eddie decided to leave the book for the time being. It wasn't until 1980 that he made a new attempt at its publication, and a complete reprint appeared with the publisher Van Gennep. Eddie's motivation for republishing was a somber one, as he was increasingly concerned about what he had hoped would never happen, a revival of intolerance and political violence, including in the West. Rather than being merely a historical report and a reckoning with what had happened, he saw Last Stop Auschwitz as a universal story illustrating how some people can continue to support and love each other even under the most extreme circumstances, retaining a certain freedom of their mental faculties, as well as a story that shows how intolerance and an extreme sense of superiority can lead to the most unimaginable deeds. The 1980 edition of the book was successful, but much to Eddie's disappointment, the publisher failed to keep the book in print. This is not to say that Eddie put it out of his head. He still realized that it was important for everyone to read what had happened in Auschwitz, and he worked on an English translation of his story until shortly before his death. 75 years after the liberation of Auschwitz, Eddie's original notebook is now being exhibited all over the world, and the book is being published worldwide. It is a tribute to all those who have suffered under terror and political violence. It is also the fulfillment of the wish Eddie expressed at the end of his story. I have to stay alive to tell all of this, to tell everyone about it, to convince people that it was true. This note on the author and the text includes a section of the afterword that Eddie De Vint wrote for the 1980 republication of Last Stop Auschwitz in the Netherlands. Further use has been made of various sources, including texts from Eddie De Vint's notebook that were not included in the original publication of Last Stop Auschwitz, Red Cross archives, the archives of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum, as well as the article by Eddie published in the NRC Handelsblad of February 14, 1981. The De Vint Family, Amsterdam, August 2019. Confrontation with Death by Eddie De Vint. The Dutch original of this article was first published in Folia Psychiatrica Neurologica et Neurochirurgica Nederlandica, Volume 52, 1949, December, pages 459 to 466. It was first published in English, in a different translation, in the International Journal of Psychoanalysis, Volume 49, 1968, pages 302 to 305. Immediately after liberation, people were keen to read everything that was published about the concentration camps. Even in those early days, some writers tried to make sociological and psychological conclusions in their work. The public devoured it all uncritically, but soon became sated. Financial worries, fears of new global catastrophes, and, above all, disillusionment about post-war relations dulled people's interest. At the same time, it is not pleasant to be constantly reminded of the suffering of others, while also feeling as if one is being held responsible because of real or alleged failings regarding those who have died or undergone great hardship. I would spare the listeners all of the horror stories about the camps if it were not for the fact that we, the former inmates, are still astonished every day by how little is known in the Netherlands about what happened there, especially in Polish camps like Auschwitz. Those who wrote about their experiences shortly after liberation did it mainly to try to find some peace of mind. By writing about the camps, one conquered one's pent-up emotions. It is understandable that readers who had to take over this burden soon had enough of it, and the interest for camp literature began to wane. Unfortunately, people threw the baby out with the bathwater by failing to subject the former inmates' academic conclusions to closer inquiry. Several years have now passed, and the memory of the camp is beginning to lose some of its torturous affective character. What was once the most hideous reality now seems like a horror film we saw in our childhood years. Fear and rage still rush at us, together with the remembered images, but they are like wild animals that have been caged. They can no longer pounce. We have distanced ourselves from them. Thanks to this distancing, we can consider what we experienced more objectively. We no longer feel caught up in the atmosphere of the camp, but think about how to convey it at our desks, studying it the way a chemist observes reactions in test tubes. We see the camp with its streets and barracks, and inside them, as reagents, the people. We let the circumstances affect them and watch the way they change. The experiment takes place. We are familiar with many of the Germans' experiments, dermatological, surgical, and numerous others. I have studied the protocols in Nuremberg, which the SS Lagerärzte wrote for Brandt, the Führer's personal physician. I shall spare you the horrors. But there was one experiment I couldn't find any report of, the experiment Camp. The Germans are not aware of the meaning of the camp as a social psychological experiment. It is up to us now to draw up these protocols. Much has been written about man in mortal danger. I remember the well-known publication in which Dr. M. G. Vroom describes the experience of deadly peril during bombing raids. In this situation, however, and also for troops at the front, the threat of death has a different meaning than it does for the inmates of a camp. For the former, the threat is acute, whereas for the latter, it is chronic, and unlike soldiers who have a sense of fighting for their lives, prisoners are also defenseless. We immediately think of the experiences of Dostoevsky, which he, autobiographically, describes for us in The Idiot. But in the case of an execution, that last hope, having which it is so immeasurably less dreadful to die, is taken away from the wretch, and certainty substituted in its place. There is his sentence, and with it that terrible certainty that he cannot possibly escape death, which, I consider, must be the most dreadful anguish in the world. You may place a soldier before a cannon's mouth in battle and fire upon him, and he will still hope. But read to that same soldier his death sentence, and he will either go mad or burst into tears. Who dares to say that any man can suffer this without going mad? Later in The Idiot, we read about a condemned man who is standing on the scaffold. What should I do if I were not to die now? What if I were to return to life again? He said that this thought weighed so upon him and became such a terrible burden upon his brain that he could not bear it, and wished they would shoot him quickly and have done with it. Running through these quotes, we see two lines of thought. First, that it seemed inconceivable to Dostoevsky that someone could have the certainty of a death sentence and not go insane. Second, that as soon as death has become a certainty, the tension becomes so unbearable that one longs for death as the only escape from the tension. Of the 4.5 million Jews who arrived in Auschwitz, 4,000 at most, 1 per 1,000 survived. Footnote: it is not known exactly how many people were sent to Auschwitz or how many died there. Historians tend to estimate that around 1.3 million people were sent to the camp and that 1.1 million people were murdered there. Most of those who died knew the inevitability of death. Nonetheless, they did not go mad. Let us investigate how that was possible. To understand the thoughts and emotions of camp inmates confronted with death, we need to review what the Jews had been through before their deportation to Auschwitz. In Amsterdam and in Westerbork, for instance, the mentality of the Jews was characterized by a tremendous repression of reality. Despite the fact that everyone could rationally understand that they too would one day be compelled to make the journey to Poland, everyone convinced themselves that they would avoid it, and the gassing in Poland, discussed on BBC Radio as early as 1941, was something people simply didn't want to hear about. Reality was fobbed off with the words British propaganda. It was only when they were on a train crossing the Dutch border that everyone realized just how fictitious the sense of security that had been maintained with Jewish council stamps and all kinds of German lists and other assurances had been. Because of this repression of reality and their fictitious sense of security, the great majority of Dutch Jews never made any attempt to save themselves through flight or resistance, as opposed to Jews such as those in the Warsaw Ghetto, who were realists with centuries of training in resistance to anti-Semitism. The Germans cunningly promoted this process of repression in the Netherlands by making Westerbork a good camp, where many facilities were provided. Deportation still remained inevitable, and when, on the train to Poland, repression became unsustainable, another defense mechanism took effect. People succumbed to a hypomanic mood. The crowd was like a frightened child who sings in the dark to hide his fear. One pulled out a guitar. A second started to sing, infecting a third with his cheerfulness, and soon the whole cattle truck was singing along. The perversely cheerful mood was intensified by the sight of bombed cities in Germany, and, consciously at least, the fear of the camp disappeared completely. When the train then stopped for a long time in the yards at the railway station of the town of Auschwitz, there was only one longing: to set off again and reach the camp as quickly as possible. Nobody realized that this arrival would probably be their end. After many hours, the train started rolling again, only to stop soon afterward at a long embankment in the green countryside. Standing on the embankment were shaven-headed men in striped convict uniforms. As the train pulled up, they rushed over to the wagons and jerked open the doors. In that instant, the repression was still in effect. A doctor who had made the journey in the same wagon as me with his wife and child remarked, "Look, they're prisoners from a concentration camp. They have to help us with our baggage." This man was like a tourist on a merry mountain hike who is oblivious to all danger until the avalanche comes crashing down on him. Arrival in a concentration camp is a severe psychic trauma, akin to being buried by an avalanche. The facts rush at the newcomers so fast that they are in danger of being crushed by them. 80% of the travelers were loaded onto large trucks. These were the old, the invalids, and the mothers with children. They were taken to the Bad- und Desinfektionsraum. There, in the hermetically sealed washroom, they were summoned by loudspeaker to breathe in deeply to disinfect the lungs of contagious diseases. What went through these people's minds in the instant they realized that the gas was poisonous is something we can scarcely imagine. As cruel as their fate was, it would be too speculative to go into their emotions during the moment of stupefaction. We will follow the others, the strong young people, closely. The psychic trauma took place in several phases. After the doors of the goods wagons had been thrown open, the prisoners drove the travelers out with sticks and cudgels. For the first time, the new arrivals discovered how people are treated in a concentration camp, not just by the SS, but also by some categories of prisoners with long experience of camp life. In Auschwitz, these were mostly Poles. Then all the baggage had to be thrown onto a pile, and one said goodbye to the last material possessions one had brought from home. But what followed was worst of all. Long lines were formed on the embankment, the line for the elderly, the young men's line, and the young women's. People now realized the inevitable, that they were going to be split up and would have to go through a long, fearful period of uncertainty before seeing each other again. But in that instant, people still believed that they would be reunited later and called out a sincere, "Till we meet again." As the rows set in motion, the multiple psychic trauma continued step by step. After passing a barrier, the line of young men entered the grounds of the actual camp. Storage yards for building supplies, large ramshackle sheds, and enormous stacks of bricks and timber. There were small trains propelled by hand power and large wagons pulled by 15 to 20 men, all dressed in prison uniforms. Here and there along the road, there were factories with the hum of machinery coming from the inside, then more timber, bricks, and sheds. There was life everywhere, and everywhere buildings were being built. The newcomers began to make associations with descriptions of forced labor in previous centuries, galley slaves and convicts, and then came the incomprehensible thought, now I am a convict too. Things one had only known from books, Dostoevsky's House of the Dead, and from the film I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, suddenly became reality. Then the lads were at the gate and seeing the camp they would have to live in for the first time. Above the gate, in decorative cast iron, the concentration camp slogan, Arbeit macht frei. A suggestion designed to reconcile the thousands who would enter here to their fate by offering them a glimmer of hope. Keeping that hope alive until the last moment was part of the camp system. Besides, perhaps in individual threats, the SS never admitted that extermination was the goal. Artificially launched rumors seeped through the crowded camp like an anesthetic poison, feeding irrational illusions and keeping the prisoners from active resistance. The suggestion that work would set you free was soon rendered ineffective by the first conversations with more senior camp residents, among them some of our compatriots. The truth about the tortures, infectious diseases, starvation, and especially the weekly recurring selections, in which the weakest were picked out and taken to the gas chambers, was flung mercilessly in the newcomers' faces. I remember speaking to a Dutchman, perhaps an hour after my arrival in the camp. He was a strong, well-built young man who also looked well-nourished. He predicted that none of us would get out alive. I still clung to him. How long have you been here, then? A year. But then it must be bearable. Unfortunately, the Dutchman wasted no time in shattering my illusions by telling me that he was the last survivor from his transport of 1,000 people. He was a champion boxer, and the SS appreciated his boxing skills so much that they had taken him under their wing. In this way, we soon knew very precisely which fate was in store for us. The exhausting work, the meager daily rations, and the lack of rest already made it clear to us that camp life was unbearable. And when we first saw the wagons with the most exhausted prisoners leaving for Birkenau, the part of the camp with the crematoriums, there was no more room for doubt. Although our rational minds were convinced, irrational hope remained. Hope was mainly nourished by the rumors, which were, in turn, fed by hope. But besides this, there were also peculiar facts. For instance, many of the prisoners worked in Krupp and IG Farben factories and in the so-called Deutsche Ausrüstungswerkstätte. There they were given certain privileges, an extra half-liter of soup and sometimes extra bread, a straw mattress to themselves that they didn't need to share with two or three other men. Sometimes they even got pay, a Prämienschein of 1 mark, which they could use to buy onions in the canteen or lavatory paper, an enormous luxury. If we spoke to the older prisoners about these facts, they only responded with a sneer. They knew all too well how it would end. Nonetheless, they had to admit that something had changed in the camp, and when we sometimes bemoaned our fate, they mocked us. You have no idea what a camp is. Compared to our day, it's a sanatorium here now. We were constantly hurled back and forth from hope to dread, from emotional, irrational hope to reasoned dread, the virtual certainty that this would all mean the end. This mixture of conflicting responses is not that strange. It is familiar to everyone. But in the camp, the divergence was so strong, there was such a distance between thought and emotion, that it was scarcely possible to speak of a mixture anymore. It was so overwhelming that there were two consciousnesses living in each person, one knowing and the other hoping, moving independently of each other, and having virtually no influence on each other. The certainty of the approaching end gave rise to a numbed resignation. But in those urgent moments when a prisoner was in danger of succumbing, the quiet hope was a stimulus to hold out a little longer. In this way, one always lasted a little longer in the camp than one could have lasted according to human calculations. The six phases of the confrontation with the concentration camp had the effect of an equal number of psychic traumas: the confiscation of the baggage, the separation of the families, the impressions of the people working outside the camp, the sight of the camp with its electrified barbed wire, the shaving and the tattooing with the Häftlingsnummer, and above all, the newcomers' communications with the senior prisoners, are comparable to the most intense traumas we see in the field of traumatic neuroses. And the reaction to these traumas was the same as the reaction to an intense acute shock. The result was a stuporous condition. Stupor characterized the prisoners' behavior in the first weeks. They were quiet and inhibited, and unable to understand the snarled orders in concentration camp jargon. They found it impossible to get the soup, which they would later crave, down their throats, and the slowness of their reactions made an extremely stupid impression on the more senior prisoners, and especially the SS. This was the blödes Schwein stage in which many perished. When they failed to properly follow the orders they had not understood, they were beaten to death, or their awkward behavior resulted in their being assigned to the heaviest commandos, where they had to carry out unbearable labor. There were also some, though these were the least in number, who showed a different attitude right from the start. They refused to bend the knee and behaved fairly arrogantly, trying to withstand the law of the concentration camp with their iron will and putting on a show of bravery. They too soon went under. Rather than blöd, they were fraîche, and those who were fraîche were also beaten to death, albeit for other reasons than the blöde. Still, there were also some who, after a short while, managed to find an attitude that made it possible to bear the camp over a longer period, thanks to a peculiar kind of adaptation, which is such an interesting phenomenon that I would like to take as an additional subject for this study. And although I realize that what I will now say is still very incomplete and in many points disputable, I believe nonetheless that I have sufficient material to justify elaborating my chain of thought for you. To immediately give you a picture of a prisoner who found the right style, I will read you a passage from the case history of a patient who spent a long time in camps and recently came to me because of the difficulties he is having adapting. The patient said the following: "I don't understand myself how I came through it. Of the 400 men who were transported to Buna with me, only 30 were left after a year. I always just let myself go. When the capo hit me, I thought, just beat me to death. When there was a bombing raid, I thought, if only I'm lucky enough to be hit by a bomb. I was completely apathetic. When the Dutch lads spoke to me, I thought, ah, just let them talk, and couldn't follow the conversation. The capo said, I don't understand why you're not in the crematorium yet. I shirked work as much as I could, and if they noticed, they'd sometimes beat me to the ground. I didn't care. In the end, I didn't feel the blows anymore. I didn't bleed from them anymore either. Once during a selection, I was written down, standing among dozens of Musulmen. The next day, I presented to the Lagerarzt, who asked me what my profession was. I said, warehouse man. If I'd said diamond cutter, I'd have been gone. They always said, all you Jews are good for is cutting diamonds and doing business. On an impulse, I answered, warehouse man. In this man, we see a remarkable capacity to let insult and injury pass him by virtually unnoticed. Later, we even heard from him that eventually, he almost found it pleasant to be tormented. The line from Exodus we can find on the urn tomb in Westerbork is applicable to him: pure oil from olives, beaten, beaten and pounded, to bear suffering as light. Although I can't go too deeply into the theoretical background of this capacity to bear suffering as light, I would like to draw several parallels and would primarily recall what Freud has described for us in Beyond the Pleasure Principle, although it's certainly not necessary to quote Freud in this company. And we are also familiar with just how much the death drive Freud posits in that essay is still a moot point. Nonetheless, we must admit that people like the patient I have just described had adapted strongly to the idea of dying. And in their cases, we can clearly apply the opinion of Eugène Carpe, who puts it a little more broadly when he says that people whose individual earthly existence has become unbearable because of certain tensions long for a resolution of this existence and a continuation in another. And is it not abundantly clear that the stupor we have described in the newcomers was a consequence of this death principle? The prisoner who had actually given up on life under the influence of psychic trauma had reconciled himself to the idea of dying. He was certain that he would one day get out of the camp, but believed, to express it in concentration camp terms, that it would be durch den Kamin, by way of the crematorium chimney. Or in other words, I will definitely get out, if not horizontally, vertically. The prisoner was like a Raskolnikov. He sought misery and humiliation. For him, blows and hunger were no longer traumas, but aids to achieve his goal, death. If this condition continued, death would be the result. If the prisoner did not get beaten to death, he would die from disease, and it was apparent that the exceptionally florid tubercular processes we saw in the camp were exacerbated by a desire to die. We have seen that the man who surrendered completely to the camp soon perished, but the man who resisted with all his vitality exhausted his energies quickly as well, using up his mental and physical reserves in a futile struggle against the law of l'univers concentrationnaire. This brings us to the paradox that reconciling oneself to death was a vital condition for the prisoner, that it was necessary for him to submit, and that his only chance of staying alive was if he, alongside this submission, which really can be called a form of inner acceptance, retained sufficient vitality to give the right answer at critical moments, just as our patient, who had let himself go completely, answered warehouseman instead of diamond cutter in the moment when the Lagerarzt was choosing his victims for the gas chambers. Compared to ordinary life, staying alive in the camp required a different relationship between vitality and what I, to avoid discussions about the term death drive, would like to call the death principle. Whereas in ordinary life, vitality generally has the upper hand and the death principle only dominates in pathological conditions such as melancholy, its domination in the concentration camp was a necessity. To summarize, I can say that the stuporous prisoner who was completely dominated by the death principle perished from it, as did those who resisted the camp with all their vitality. The prisoner who wanted to have a chance of life had to develop a certain camp psyche, the deeper basis of which was an altered attitude to death. Let us now analyze the factors that made the emergence of such a camp psyche possible. In the first instance, several physical factors. Various experiences, particularly in the last war, have made it clear how much deficiencies play a role in the decline of mental function. This decline is not regular, but selective. The vitamin B complex in particular seems to play a role. During the autopsies carried out by Russian doctors on prisoners who had died after liberation, I saw very remarkable abnormalities. The intestinal wall had become as thin as parchment, which was explained as epithelium loss from B deficiency. In cerebro, we saw petechiae, a presentation similar to that of Wernicke encephalopathy, and although there is still a shortage of facts regarding deficiency psychoses, I would like to draw attention to experiments by American researchers who evoked psychotic states by putting experimental subjects on a diet that was low in vitamin B6, niacin. May I also draw attention to Grevel's description of anemia perniciosa, not a direct result of malnutrition, but nonetheless a deficiency disease. Speed of action and resilience decline. The same applies to thought processes. Psychological tone is reduced. Sometimes there are oversensitivities, including to pain and emotions. Apathy alternates with fits of anger, irritability, and affectability. It is apparent that these few facts require further study. Nonetheless, I am convinced that we will gain the most not from studies of the prisoners' physical conditions, but by paying particular attention to the sociological conditions in which they lived. And this brings us to the second group of factors that give rise to the development of a camp psyche. The word sociological may sound inflated until one realizes that a conglomeration of tens of thousands up to as many as 200,000 people, as in Auschwitz-Birkenau, cannot simply be seen as an unstructured crowd. Instead, various social ranks operated within this mass and could not but influence the psychological condition of the individuals. In order to explain the social relations in the concentration camps, I must first summarize several facts from the history of these camps. The first ones were set up in 1933, small camps with 200 to 300 prisoners each. These had a purely political function in relation to the Nazi takeover. In addition, they were a practicing ground for SS methods. The SS was trained there for its later task of European domination. Around the start of the war, the camp's second function developed. The mass extermination of the Jews became an economic necessity for the German conduct of the war. This led to the large death camps Majdanek and Treblinka, and the largest, Auschwitz. But once such enormous SS cities had arisen, it turned out that these could also fulfill a further function. In 1937, Pohl, who was in charge of the economic side of the camps, uttered his historic words, "Warum sollte die SS nichts verdienen? Why shouldn't the SS earn anything?" And increasingly, from then on, the camps became enormous factories in which the prisoners labored as brutally exploited workers. Initially, all of the prisoners in the camps were treated equally badly, but gradually a separate class arose among them of prisoners favored by the SS, the Kapos, and Blockälteste, who served as an extension of the SS and allowed them to put as many prisoners as possible to work. In 1937, the first public limited companies in concentration camps were created. The shareholders were members of the SS. During the war, important branches of German industrial concerns, Krupp, IG Farben, were established in the camps. The prisoners were hired from the SS for 6 marks a day. In his book, The Theory and Practice of Hell, Kogon calculated that the profit per prisoner per day was approximately 4 marks, which across all camps came to hundreds of thousands of marks a day and billions over the whole war. After all, 9.5 million people died there, of whom approximately 40% produced several months of profit for the SS. As long as there were enough Jews and political adversaries in all of the countries of Europe, the SS was reckless with prisoners' lives. But around 1943, the supply began to dwindle, and it therefore became necessary to relax the regime in the camps to safeguard war production and SS profiteering. This gave the prisoners a little breathing space. We see that the SS had two contradictory goals with its prisoners. On the one hand, rapid and efficient mass extermination. On the other, sparing them for the economic benefit they could generate. In 1944, This split in the mentality of the camp reached a climax with the double function of death camp and economically essential labor camp. The remarkable tension that existed in the prisoners between surrendering to death and their constantly recurring bursts of vitality, the inner ambivalence being thrown back and forth between hope and dread, was sustained by its emotional resonance with the split nature of the social environment. This already indicates a likely link between two apparently independent phenomena, the sociological structure of the camp and the prisoner's psychic structure. We see how a social form that is essentially different from any society we know can also cause psychological changes of a depth we could not have previously suspected. It goes without saying that there is important individual variation in the ability to adjust to the camp environment by developing the psychic state described above. There was a great difference between the reactions of Eastern European Jews with their strong Slavic streak, who had been accustomed to anti-Semitism from an early age, and those of Western Jews. When it came to the Dutch, the Jewish proletarians, the orange vendor from Waterloo Square and the cigar maker from Eilenburg, were made of sterner stuff than members of the prosperous middle class, whose entire facade of self-importance collapsed at the first blow or swear word, at least when they had no deeper source of self-esteem than their social position. In general, in the camp, we saw that those whose lives had some kind of religious alignment, this in the broadest sense, also as devotion to a political system or a humanistic philosophy, were the quickest to recover from the initial stupor. It is therefore no coincidence that both the faithful Christians and those who would seem to be their psychological opposites, the communists, were best at holding their own in the camp, and even found opportunities to achieve some degree of anti-fascist organization. The same phenomenon was seen in the Dutch resistance, with the close-knit groups around the underground newspapers Trouw and De Waarheid. Of course, the adaptive mechanisms described previously did not apply to the ruling group among the prisoners, the capos and blokelteste, often sadists and psychopaths, and as bad as the SS buddies they drank with and joined in visits to the brothel. But of those prisoners who suffered the full misery of the camp, it can be said that, inasmuch as they managed to stick it out, it was because they had so deeply reconciled themselves to the idea of going under, and because the normally dominant vital urge only manifested itself incidentally in truly critical moments. A small reserve of this will to live could be kept for those moments, because in the background of consciousness, the thought remained alive that existence might have another meaning than just making it through another day. Even now, years after the war, we regularly see how difficult it is to reverse the far-reaching alteration of personality that took place in the camps. For this reason, it seems to me that an insight into the living conditions that formed the people in the camps, which I have sketched briefly here, is a necessary prerequisite if we are to offer help to the disequilibrated former prisoners who visit our practices. This has been a Hachette Audio production of Last Stop Auschwitz, My Story of Survival from Within the Camp, written by Eddie DeVint, translated from Dutch by David Colmer, read by Robert Fass. Produced by Christine M. Farrell. Recorded by Charles McCrory and Michelle Figueroa. Post-production by Chris Candio. Last Stop Auschwitz is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 1946 by Eddie DeVint. Revised text copyright 2020, Estate of Eddie DeVint. English translation copyright 2020 by David Colmer. Audio production copyright 2020, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.